Looking for used furniture or other odds and ends? The Guelph Food Bank is holding its annual summer series of fundraising garage sales, barbecues, and silent auctions starting Friday and Saturday, May 1st and 2nd. This is a great way to get a great deal and support a vital community network. The series takes place most Fridays and Saturdays over the summer from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. at 100 Crimea Street in Guelph. This is a physically accessible location. For the full schedule, check out guelphfoodbank.ca under Volunteers and Support.
Hi, I'm Doug Blackwood. I've been hosting Seems Like Old Times for about 25 years now, featuring music and old radio 1930s to 50s. The show also focuses on issues and history-oriented subjects for older adults. If you know of something that would make a good topic of discussion, or would like to hear a piece of music or old radio show repeated, why not email me at seemslikeoldtimes@cfru.ca. Seems Like Old Times, Wednesdays from 2 to 4 p.m. on CFRU 93.3 FM.
Guelph Food Bank will again be holding its summer series of fundraising garage sales, barbecues, and silent auctions all throughout the months of May to September, rain or shine. The fundraisers will take place at 100 Crimea Street, a physically accessible location. The proceeds from these sales help us cover our yearly heat and hydro costs, and they're a great way to get a deal and support a great cause. For a list of all fundraising dates, please visit guelphfoodbank.ca. Come on out for some great deals and show your support for the Guelph Food Bank.
My name is Maheen, and you're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
Attention comrades of Canadian DIY communities and underground art scenes.
This is our house, Weird Distro, the first and only not-for-profit online store for Canadian-made cassettes, LPs, CDs, and objets d'art.
One stop, one package, one massive country.
Run by Weird Canada volunteers.
For music to hold in your hands and your hearts, check out Weird Distro at distro.weirdcanada.com.
Tune in to Planet Groove for Funky Fridays on CFRU from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. with your Funky Funky Blues Doctor for a stir-fry of funk, rock, blues, metal, and more. That's 10 a.m. every Friday on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
I spy with my little eye a riddle. Find the spot where students come to show off their creative spark and walk through this great art park. To find the answer to this clue, find Bonfire, John McRae's greatest companion. Do you know the answer? Pick up an iSpy card and fill in question number 10. iSpy Guelph is a do-it-yourself scavenger hunt, drawing inspiration from the traditional iSpy game. To commemorate the 100th anniversary of In Flanders Fields, iSpy takes you on a journey of John McRae's life in Guelph. All iSpy locations are outdoors, open to Guelph residents of all ages, and wheelchair accessible. iSpy cards can be picked up at the Information Center in City Hall, at any Guelph Public Library branch, or you can print one at guelph.ca/iSpy. To get your prize, return a completed iSpy card to the Tourism Information Center located in City Hall from now until August 28th. Good luck, iSpyers!
You're listening to Back in the USSR. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Killing Joke with Love Like Blood. And a very appropriate song to be playing on the occasion of, well, the 4th of July. And, of course, we also just had Canada Day earlier this week. A day which I definitely did not celebrate on. You know, as much as I have faith, or I try to have faith in the people of this land, you know, I cannot celebrate a day that celebrates a nation based on stolen indigenous land and based on genocide. This is the real history of our country. This is what we have to come to grips with. This is what we have to confront. You know, in this land I would very much love it, like to love. You know, I cannot bring myself to celebrate on that day. Especially, you know, you see these kind of manifestations of Canadian nationalism upon that day. I mean, you see the, in Calgary, you know, actually even before Canada Day, the musical ride this year featured, you know, RCMP units in, you know, full body armor with the heavy weapons and all this kind of stuff just breaking out and, like, almost demonstrating the repressive state apparatus of the settler colonial state here in this country. You know, just there for all to see. You know, putting on a display of force, you know, about what the repressive capabilities that this the RCMP has. You know, this force which has traditionally been a force for repressing indigenous people in this country, as well as, like, striking workers and various dissident elements within society. You know, we saw what they did in the Winnipeg General Strike, for example, you know, where they, you know, several people were killed, were shot by the police, the RCMP. You know, we know what these guys are capable of. You know, and this is supposedly a symbol of Canadian nationalism. You know, this is a symbol of the Canadian state as it now exists. This show of force. I can't get behind that. You know, I cannot get behind that. I cannot support that. You know, let alone what's going to be happening on this day, July 4th. You know, where we see, of course, like the American Empire celebrating its own brand of nationalism, which is inseparable from imperialism. You know, it's an empire. How could it not be? You know, and this really stuck out to me in particular because I was thinking a lot about these different forms of how people define national identity around the world and how different it is in different countries, and how I've experienced different forms of nationalism going to different countries, going to places like China. And I wrote an article for this. I still don't know if it's actually going to be published, but I mean, I wrote it for the upcoming issue of The Peak. Yeah, you know, the alternative magazine here in Guelph, which is doing an issue. The next issue of the is going to be on nationalism and ideas of nationalism, how it's defined and this sort of stuff. And one of the things that's very, very important to know about nationalism is it really depends. How it manifests depends on the country in question, its relationship to imperialism. You know, is it an imperialist power, you know, or is it a historically colonized country that gained its independence through fighting against imperialism and had to fight, like, a long and bloody war as Algeria did, as Cuba did, as Vietnam did, as Iraq did, as all these countries which had formerly been colonized, all of them, you know, defined themselves as a nation through anti-colonial struggle. You know, and that's how their form of national identity manifests itself. It's seen through that. And certainly going to China, you know, which is a country that does, where nationalism is really defined by anti-colonial struggle and is inseparable from the long and bloody struggle, you know, in the early 20th century to kick imperialist powers out of China. That, to this day, really is the foundations of Chinese nationalism. And it's very, very different from, like, say, Canadian nationalism, where, you know, I mean, I was working in northern China for a year as part of the public school system. I couldn't help but notice the colossal differences between what Chinese children are educated to believe about imperialism and empire as compared to what I was taught to believe growing up in the Ontario school system. Because in Canada, the education system goes to great lengths to normalize and sanitize empire and colonization. You know, the arrival of European explorers like Champlain, Cartier, and Cabot is viewed as natural and progressive. the colonization of indigenous lands is portrayed as inevitable and desirable, while the genocide against indigenous peoples either goes unmentioned or is trivialized to the point of meaninglessness. And the British Empire, that of course gave birth to the modern settler state of Canada, is still largely portrayed as a benign and civilizing force. You know, its crimes and, you know, colossal crimes over three centuries are not even talked about. You know, of course, in China, it's the opposite. Chinese school children learn how various European empires, along with the Empire of Japan, invaded their country, plundered its resources, killed and exploited the Chinese people, and were only driven out through a long and bloody national liberation struggle that culminated in the Chinese Revolution of 1949. You know, so while Canadian students learn about how Canadian soldiers fought and died for the British Empire at Vimy Ridge, and how that openly racist defender of colonialism and destroyer of indigenous communities, John A. Macdonald, was somehow a great nation builder, Chinese students learn about how heroic volunteers gave their lives in countless battles against the Japanese invaders, the colossal obstacles overcome by Mao Zedong and his comrades in the celebrated Long March of 1934-35, and how modern China rose in defiance of colonial powers to be the powerful and successful nation that it is today. In Canada, by contrast, the topic of how this country became so wealthy, you know, by global standards, is taboo. And land theft, you know, things like land theft, ongoing Aboriginal genocide, and the colonial exploitation remain skeletons in our proverbial closet that no one wants to talk about. So in short, in Canada, we're taught that empire is natural and even noble. You know, at least what it's the European empire. Whereas in China, students are taught to view empire as something that is thoroughly unnatural, a monstrous abomination that had to be defeated at terrible cost. And that's really the fundamental difference between Canadian national identity, which in many ways celebrates empire, or at least seeks to normalize it, and Chinese national identity, which is really defined through the struggle against empire, through against imperialism, against colonialism, for the liberation of their country. You know, and that is a massive contrast. You know, shocking contrast that is the case. That really is the case. You know, and that was just exposed to me every step of the way. You know, whether it was at the university I was teaching at, or at the middle school I was teaching at part-time, you know, the stuff that was in the curriculum, you know, the stuff that was in curriculum, the stuff that was being taught, and just how, you know, just how it completely differed from what I was used to in my own country. You know, it was very, very sobering to see that. And of course, like, I write about this sort of thing in the article for The Peak. And another thing which, of course, did come up is I had to admit to my Chinese students that Canada is not my motherland. It's not my motherland. You know, those Chinese students I was teaching, China was their motherland. You know, they knew that they were indigenous to that land. You know, the Chinese people had been there for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. This was their land. But I, of course, could not say the same thing about Canada. Or, of course, even though my family, at least on the Irish side of my family, has been here 150 years, we're still settlers on this land. We still settled on Attawandrong territory in the vicinity of Arthur, just north of Fergus. And, you know, we're settlers on this land. You know, this is not our motherland. You know, it's even very, very hypocritical to even call this our land, you know, our nation. You know, this is someone else's nation. This is someone else's land. This is the indigenous people's land. And we have to acknowledge that. And of course, very, very few people actually do acknowledge that when they're out there painting their faces red and white on Canada Day. You know, let alone on the 4th of July in the United States, because, I mean, the same principle applies. You know, of course, the last thing that a colonial state or an empire wants to acknowledge is the atrocities that went into its creation. You know, the theft of land, the massacres, the genocide, all that sort of stuff. They don't want to talk about that. Meanwhile, if you're on the receiving end of that colonial process, as China was, you know, you are going to talk about it. Because the struggle against the monstrous crimes of imperialism, the struggle against colonialism, ultimately defined you as a nation. You know, you got your freedom as a nation, you got your independence as a nation because you fought against that. You know, and they're not going to forget about that kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, so like, there couldn't be more contrast between these things. So that's pretty much what this show is going to be about. You know, that's what the show is going to be about. And the way I want to start the show is I actually want to talk once again about some of the, just to refresh some of your memories, I guess. I'm going to play a clip by Stephanie Adohi talking at the Workers' World Party convention, I believe, like just last year, talking about what colonization really meant. You know, the real face of colonialism and European imperialism in the Americas, because it's something that we really need to confront full on, stare it in the face, and see it for what it was and what it is. If we're gonna overcome this legacy, you know, that continues to taint North America, you know, the world to this day. You know, if we're gonna overcome this legacy of imperialism. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
On October 12, 1995, BAI interviewed a progressive Italian-American historian. I think her name was Jennifer Guglielmo. I didn't write it down then. She stated that it was promoted by the Mussolini backers, and that at that time the Italian working class was largely socialist and anarchist and had fought them in the streets. It was made at a holiday in 1937. But let's go back to 1492 when Spain was in the Reconquista. They made war to expel the Moors, as we all know. Isabella and Ferdinand, they wanted new riches, trade, colonies. The conquistadores sailed on their orders. They bankrolled them. Christopher Columbus was apparently no Italian. His name was Cristobal Colon. He was a Spanish pirate. If the queen had known this, she'd have executed him. There's no evidence that he was ever in Genoa, the city he claimed. He read and wrote a lot, and of all his many papers he left, none of it's written in the tongue of Genoa. Okay, so he landed. He assessed the ready welcome of his friendly host, the Taino people, and he decided to attack, to kill, and take power. There are stories of him cutting off the arms of Taino men to feed to his war dogs. He wrote to the queen immediately to convince her of the idea of making them slaves. Yes, Columbus invented the slave trade. He said, they would make good servants. They're fit to be ordered about and made to work. And with 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want. Most of the slaves he sent back to Spain died quickly, and after a few years, Isabella and Ferdinand sent an investigator, Bobadilla, who arrived in Santo Domingo to find men jailed, lined up to be hanged as rebels. He ordered Columbus arrested at that time, and Columbus' personal cook, Espinosa, put the chains on him. Once the first reports came back to Spain from Pizarro and from Cortes about the gold and silver in Peru and Mexico and the slavery, a steady stream of conquistadors moved out, all of them bankrolled by the monarchs. The conquistadors, Colon, Columbus, Cortes, Pizarro, Oñate, Coronado, De Soto, and many others. From their contemporary descriptions by those who knew them, we could characterize them maybe as a kind of a lumpen, sort of completely out of control mercenary force. They were motivated by arrogance, religious superiority, and greed. They used the requirement, the requerimiento, I believe it's pronounced. It was a three-paragraph announcement by the Spanish monarchy and the church in Rome to submit to these men, their representatives, or else knives and guns would next be used. And that was their excuse for murder, rape, torture, robbery on a level never before seen, enslavement of whole indigenous nations in gold and silver mines, all in the name of the monarchs and the church. It's not possible for us to touch on all of them tonight, but I think it's important for all of us to know which ones are most hated still and which ones did the most damage. Isabella got wealth beyond all imagining. So did everyone who was with Francisco Pizarro, butcher of the Incas. Now, the Incas today, when we hear about them, they're either described as an empire or they're socialist and communist. We do know that they're the successors of an ancient farming communities which held land in common, and they were observed at that time distributing stores of supplies in the urban areas from warehouses to everyone in need, and they kept records of them. They gave supplies to the sick, elderly, poor, widows, and disabled. There's ruins at the city of Huanco who have 500 such warehouses that held over 1 million square feet of goods. The Incas were highly skilled in working gold and silver and platinum. They used a lot of bronze, but there was no iron available there. They were the world's finest weavers. They domesticated llamas and alpacas for pack wool, meat. They were astute record keepers, but being weavers, they made all of their records with these intricate woven fringes of knotted string, and they had storehouses full of these archives of their records. They had advanced base 10 math with zeros and place notation. They had 14,000 paved roads running through the mountains, often stepped for the pack animals. Cusco at that time was 50 to 100,000 people, and there were a lot of smaller cities and towns. Pizarro, who was described by those who knew him as ruthless and devious, he tricked the Incas into who had underestimated him based on reports that these were lazy robbers. He and his men attacked and killed 10,000 people at Atahualpa's court in an hour and a half. The court was unarmed because they had no fear of these men, and they fought to the last to defend themselves in Atahualpa, even as they cut their hands off and took him hostage. Atahualpa then offered the Spanish a personal ransom, a room full of gold and two of silver. For the next several months, llamas were carrying gold back from all over the Andes, from stripped temples and palaces. The outside walls of Cusco's main temple alone held a ton and a half of gold plates. The entire ransom came to 7 tons of gold and 13 of silver, all of it in the form of artwork and jewelry and so forth. It has been estimated at $65 million based on the price of $400 an ounce, and I think that's out of date. No king in Europe had ever seen or even heard of anything like this sort of wealth. And you know, the conquistadors, they just melted it all down. It took them about a month at a quarter ton a day. Pizarro then killed Atahualpa anyway and went on a rampage of plunder for more. In some buildings, they found 20-foot planks of silver. They took jewels off mummies. They killed so many people and the llamas that the public works and including the irrigation canals fell into decay, and the llamas were almost exterminated. Spain and Portugal had signed a treaty, by the way, in 1494 to divvy up colonies, and Portugal got the easternmost part of Brazil and Africa, and Spain took everything this side. Spain at that point was getting $30 million in gold every year shipped over, so much so that it became a target for the English, French, and Dutch pirates. Francis Drake alone captured $40 million in gold. Spain used that gold for a series of wars against France and the Turks, and then in the war against Protestantism. By the time their armada was sunk, they'd spent the treasury, but their programs of colonization and missionaries continued long after. The huge amounts of gold that went to Europe that were stolen didn't just fund wars and more conquest expeditions. They changed Europe. The bourgeoisie had its role in outfitting these wars and missions. Huge quantitative change led to qualitative change in the power of the bourgeoisie as they grew, and it directly led to the rise of capitalism. And colonialism just exploded in size in utter immense robberies of previously unknown rapaciousness. Getting back to the conquistadors, Coronado. He was known for wandering all over the Southwest in search of the seven cities of gold and Quivira. He attacked, occupied, and burned several pueblos. And in fact, if any of you have been to the Southwest and visited some of the pueblos, what's left now is less than a third of what there was at that time. They were all the way into the Texas Panhandle. In the 60s, when I was a kid, my dad took me to see the site of a collapsed Kiva in the Panhandle. And if you're ever driving from Albuquerque up to Santa Fe and you go through Bernalillo, out west of Bernalillo, there's a park where you can go and see where there's one or two ruins there where Coronado personally burnt down the pueblos. Oñate. He was known for working thousands to death in the gold and silver mines in Zacatecas, and he left to take over New Mexico. He's hated to this day in New Mexico. He attacked Acoma Pueblo, which is known as like the Thousand Year City or whatever. I think some of you have been there. In 1599, when it rose up against the settlers, the Spanish killed 800 children, women, and men. Oñate then ordered every man over 25 to have a foot cut off and serve 25 years of slavery. Every female and male between the ages of 12 and 25 got 25 years of slavery. And 60 young girls were sent to priests in Mexico, never to return. To this day, they can't build a statue in New Mexico and all the way to El Paso without huge protests from the Pueblos. And generally, eventually, those statues, there will be a foot sawed off, and no one ever knows who did it, you know? The one at the airport in El Paso, though, there was such protest against it that they just renamed Oñate the Equestrian. There were rebellions against Spain and the conquistadors. The biggest was in the Andes in Peru, led by Tupac Amaru number 2. There were records of the Incas melting gold down and pouring it down the throats of the conquistadors they captured. But the second biggest was in what's today New Mexico in 1680. Some say it was the Spanish fear of snakes and dolls that led them to burn 1,000-year-old Kachina dolls of the Pueblos. Others say it was the beating of Pope, who did lead the Pueblos in the revolt, and they burnt out the Spanish and kicked them out for 12 years. Pedro de Alvarado, another mass murderer, worked thousands to death in Guatemala in the mines. He hanged every local leader who tried to protect the people. He enslaved so many that the price of an Indian slave fell to 1/20th the price being paid in Mexico. Hernando de Soto was Pizarro's lieutenant, and he'd grown up, and he was proud of it, killing Indians in Panama in his teens, killing Indians in Nicaragua in his 20s. His part of Atahualpa's ransom made him a millionaire in gold, but he wanted Florida. So he went to Spain, and he got the grand bankroll, and he paid for an outfit of 600 soldiers, 200 horse, numbers of African and Mexican slaves, war dogs, and several hundred swine, and these were actually war pigs because they were trained to root out fields and flush ambushes. They left Florida north to either the Smokies or the Blue Ridge Mountains, then across the Mississippi all the way to Arkansas. And they followed the roads that were established in the paths from town to city, stealing food, burning storehouses, fields, and towns and cities, kidnapping locals to enslave, and they burned them alive if they made trouble, cut their hands off if they didn't lead them to gold. They abducted the woman ruler of a city called Talomeco in a state called Cofitachiqui, and nobody today knows if that was Jalagee or Cherokee or Creek, and killed her for her pearl necklace. The DeSoto Party recorded events, as all of these expeditions did. They saw cities and towns newly abandoned due to smallpox already spreading all over from the Spanish landings. They were the first and last outsiders to ever see the living Mississippian culture, which is today called the Mound Builders. Smallpox and 7 other disease vectors that we now know lived in DeSoto's lost war pigs that went feral spread disease everywhere through the whole Mississippi Basin and all the tributary rivers upstream. He attacked the original city of Mobile and abducted the leader, a woman. There was a huge battle and Mobile burnt down. Mobile, Alabama is named after that. The Mississippi culture mounds that remain that you can see today were actually originally great earthen pyramids showing the influence of the Mayans and others. And the Mississippi culture depended completely on corn. They had miles and miles of crops of corn. Maize corn, by the way, was the first ever in human history selectively bred food grain in the world. And its scientific history is still being debated because it's so very different from the grass teosinte that people don't know today how the indigenous gardeners changed it from like a thumb-sized, nearly inedible seed pod to all the many varieties of maize corn that were being grown here by the time Columbus came. Maize corn was being raised up and down the East Coast, all over the Mississippi Valley, the Southwest, and more. And at the same time that agriculture was developing in Mesopotamia about 10,000 years ago in Peru in the Chilca Canyon, the potato was being domesticated and cropped. The word used in Spanish for potatoes, papas, is the original Incan word. By 1491, they had thousands of varieties in existence, one for every elevation going from the Andean peaks down to the valleys. The Incans preserved great masses of the potato papas crops by mashing them and freeze-drying them, and they'd last 10 years as a food store in case of the drought. And they did all of that with wooden tools. The stories that native people took these unwashed armed men for gods is disproven over and over again by contradictory anecdotes. Incas thoroughly investigated these strange men, but they made the mistake of underestimating them in their disgust for their personal behavior and their filth. In 1502, Columbus accidentally encountered a large seagoing canoe the length of a galley off Honduras, and it was a Mayan crew. They ordered the Spaniards to get out of their way. It took the conquistadors till 1511 to figure out that the Mayans were 120 miles west of them. They were crushed at the first battle against them at, I'm not sure how to pronounce the name of the town, Champoton, 1517. But by 1519, the Spanish had begun to enslave Africans and bring them to Cuba, where subsequent excursions into the hemisphere now deployed also African slaves. There's a link in all of this with the fight against the racist use of the word savage in the anti-Muslim posters on the MTA. That and the word primitive have been used endlessly with that question for 520 years against all the indigenous peoples of the world. Columbus was savage. Capitalism, savage. Imperialism is savage, right? And we can use other words in place of primitive in our economic and political discussion, pre-class society, early accumulation of capital, original communism when we discuss humanity. Imagine the continual effect on the consciousness of just the use of these two words only over the last 200 years. People see it in literature and they accept it. People of color see it and resent it. Our youth are affected negatively, and so are our social relations with people outside our communities. The true fact is the term hunter-gatherer is generally also wrongly used. Perhaps it's accurate for the period when people around the world were first surviving the ice ages, but it's another way of saying primitive. All of humanity is adaptable and creative in learning to use the resources available and in their environments. These societies were gardening more than gathering. At some time after the last ice age in Asia and later in Europe, they domesticated livestock animals. Over here in 1491, what was actually going on across Great Turtle Island, North America, and the land of the condor, South America, was a whole hell of a lot of gardening, growing of crops, even in the forests. Over one half of all of the food crops in the world today, by numbers of species and by volume and weight, sold are indigenous to this hemisphere and were all domesticated by indigenous people, from popcorn to pumpkins, tomatoes, squash, all kinds of beans, maize corn, various berries and nuts, potatoes, chocolate, pineapples, cassava, the manioc, various palm oils, avocados, papaya, quinoa, amaranth, acai, and too many others to name, really. And all the chilies that the Spanish took all over the world that Columbus mistakenly named peppers. What's primitive about the cultivation of so many diverse food crops? What's primitive about Mayan and Incan development of the concept of the zero, of the astronomical sciences of all the ancient peoples of this world? Between 3200 and 2500 BCE, before the current era, large-scale public buildings were erected in at least seven places on the Peruvian coast. The only other urban center that we know of today at that time was Sumer on the Tigris-Euphrates. And then there's the fact that across this continent, people from small villages to cities lived communally. There were 500 nations, and most of them were still matrilineally structured. I mean, here within the U.S. alone. There's nothing primitive about a society which is so equal and free, yet completely functional, on the basis of no classes at all. And by the way, comrades and friends, Native women today typically use the word matrilineal because it doesn't imply a hierarchy. There are so many different and complex traditions of music, art, storytelling, dance, theater in our histories and still surviving. And about the agriculture in Amazonia today, in the forest, people can walk through and pick fruit to eat. Scientists tell us these are all old orchards. There were 138 crops just alone being grown in Amazonia, half of which were trees. Also, there were huge tracts of artificially built up soil. The Amazon has really bad acidic red soil, and by some today still unknown process, the people who live there in several different nations or communities created two types of very dark, nutritious soil, terra preta, for their crops, and they used charcoal, broken pottery, and probably animal and fish remains, and it provided all the needed nutrients for plants like phosphorus, calcium, sulfur, organic matter. The Amazon was being terraformed before 1492. Conservative estimates put that extent at a few thousand square miles, or 0.1 to 0.3% of the basin. That's about the size of the cropped land that the Mayans had. Others estimate up to 10%, which would be the size of France. In original communism or communalism, the form of the family was healthy and vibrant, and we call it the extended family. It provides all the support needed for the individual, for the children. Everyone knows they belong. People who are not related are adopted in as well. And there's no isolation of the self. There's no alienation from society like we see today to the detriment of our youth. By contrast, the nuclear family under bourgeois society is like a little piece of it got amputated and lacks support. The clash of cultures that began with the invasion of the conquistadors and continued with the invasions of the English and French and the Russians on the West Coast still had positive effects on the settlers, some of which enabled them to survive here, like the adoption of the food crops and various articles of clothing and other technology. The gender equality of the women was not understood or accepted by the Europeans, but they had been living under feudalism for hundreds of years. The National Women's History Project in the U.S. states many early women's rights leaders were inspired by what they call the Seneca's matriarchal society. And Ben Franklin has famously noted the impact of the Iroquois Great Law of Peace on the Constitution. And bathing was a daily practice. The British and French are often noted in records as being amazed at this because most of them had never had a bath in their lives. And the ideas that have been adopted from the fashions are too numerous to even go into. That'd be a whole other talk. But getting back to the smallpox, up until 1492, there was very little contact between these two hemispheres. No one here had any immunity to the diseases that were brought over by the invaders, precisely because these were diseases that jumped species from domesticated animals of Asia and Europe, or rats. Half the Aztecs, half the Incas, and the Mayans died before the fighting in which they were overthrown. It was more severe than the Black Death, and it killed leaders, advisors, generals, and elders. Cortes lost the first assault on the Aztec capital, Tenochtitlan. Then smallpox hit for 60 days, leaving everyone too sick to even move. And those who survived when it began to diminish faced Cortes, because he had come back by them. Disease traveled out from everywhere the Spanish and later invading forces had landed, and it traveled to every corner of the hemisphere. Okay, in 1491, it's been estimated that there were some 112 million people living in this hemisphere. The Mexican plateau alone, we know, had 25.2 million based on colonial records. And these diseases, smallpox, flu, measles, etc., killed 80 to 100 million people in 100 to 150 years. It works out to about 20% of the world's population at that time, as the UN figures that the world had 500 million people in 1600. Now, the work that was done by progressive scientists in the 50s and 60s to achieve this more realistic figure is still under attack by racists in their fields. By the time the English and the French arrived, the waves of smallpox epidemics had even left numerous villages of the dead, which the settlers found on the seaboard and across the land. Sometimes they just moved right in like the pilgrims. Decimated indigenous nations now faced waves of settlers anxious and mean with greed to steal the land and create wealth, and a totally alien perspective of the settlers and their view of the land, the environment, as something to be used and abused to make money as opposed to being stewarded and cared for to encourage the wealth of food and other resources that had been available. The indigenous nations fought back, but the fighting came long after the waves of death had shifted the balance of forces to the invaders. In 1776, we know most of the fighting wasn't against the British. It was against the Cherokee. The Americans burned 100 Jalagi villages to the ground and all of their crops to steal huge tracts of land from Virginia going south. And that whole nation was refugeed to the mountains with the shirts on their backs in the middle of the winter. And comrades and friends, did you know that today in Canada, they're honoring Tecumseh, the Shawnee leader, and a white general with tribute to saving Canada from U.S. takeover in 1812. And as all of us know, Marx and Engels were very excited to read the work of Lewis Henry Morgan, who was the first to write of the matrilineal societies in the extended family based on the Haudenosaunee. But most don't know that he met Tonawanda Seneca Ely or Eli Parker, I'm not sure how he pronounced his name, when they were both working as clerks in a bookshop upstate. He learned everything he knew from Parker, who was later General Ulysses Grant's right-hand man, the military secretary, who took the surrender at Appomattox. Going into the 19th century, the U.S. declared manifest destiny to take the West. We had the Trail of Tears, the California Gold Rush, the Plains Wars, and all of these wars and atrocities led up to the U.S. Becoming imperialist when it finally took on Spain itself in 1898. In 1891, Congress passed the Dawes Act to break up the communally owned lands of the reservations and mandated individual ownership, but in plots small enough to leave a lot of land left over for the Sooners in Oklahoma, plots too small to be viable as well. Ironically, only the Pueblos were protected from the Dawes Act because they were under the legal status of the Spanish land grants. The 1898 Curtis Act dissolved tribal governments and the courts. And there are many undocumented people in Oklahoma, including full-bloods today, who aren't able to be members because their ancestors refused to get on the rolls at a certain time and they didn't get their allotments. In Oklahoma, in World War I, when Eugene Debs was in jail under the Palmer raids, the biggest rebellion against the fratricidal war this side of the Atlantic took place, the Green Corn Rebellion, named after the Chilagi Cherokee New Year. Indigenous black and white farmers and workers came together to fight back, and they were suppressed by the National Guard. Today, capitalist society portrays all indigenous people as either completely wiped out and free to use for a Halloween costume, or only recognized if they fit a particular stereotype from Hollywood or whatever. There are so many local struggles that we never really even hear about. This is still Indian land, and the struggle continues. This is the significance of Day of Mourning. If you've never gone to Day of Mourning, I'd like to strongly urge you to get on the bus and come this year. You're going to hear from Leonard Peltier, who sends his support every year from prison in Florida this year. You'll hear about struggles across Great Turtle Island and how indigenous people view the current U.S. wars. And we salute Osceola, the leader of the Seminole Nation, the Creeks, the Southern Creeks, who had adopted the runaway slaves in Florida who never surrendered to the U.S. We look to the Green Corn Rebellion for our inspiration in the struggle, and we salute the United American Indians of New England, whose slogan is, "We're not vanishing, we are not conquered, we are as strong as ever." And if you bear with me one more minute, I'd like to make an announcement, because we also are kicking off building for Day of Mourning tonight. It's
And I would call all the world's water traitor, for the way her body brought the traders of fur, of flesh, of Black Hills gold, holding butterfly nets, wove of heartstrings so cold they were able to freeze and then capture my nation's breezes. Kidnap the Blackfoot Nat Peel, whitewashed, replaced with the half-scalped, war-painted Jesus, a strangled, slit-throat Caesar, so unable to say a tu brute, he simply mouthed the letters O and K. And as today's stray bullets pull stars from the sky, through bubble-wrapped newborn darkness I see that midnight is them and the noon is me. But now bright minds' lights have ruined the moon like the white's ruined wounded knee. They pruned our freedom, clip-snip, quick-flip, bonsai, treedom. And now we unneeded like weeds in the Garden of Eden. But me, I ain't never seen a field of dandelions trying to grow into roses. God knows Columbus needed no Moses to split the sea of my red people. He knew enough to just trust in the strength of the steeple, the breadth and length of cathedrals, God's gospel-glossed needles, force-feeding Kanata's pre-bleeding, crimson Indian summer evenings, leaving me grieving that even as we speak our spoken words, these thieves are still weaving history through tree trunks, searching for reasons to clear-cut the psyche. I think we all know that if Mikey didn't like his bowl of life, they would have let him starve. And still we wonder at the marvels of our carbon nation, Segra, Degra, congregation, and still the throngs they hasten to sing songs of race and reformation, once sung by the lungs of long-dead masons. So if here's the place, and now's the time, you run your race while I fast and pray for mine, and hunger for the days when I can release the image of my people, proud and free from the collective walls of imagination. But right now, North America's just a fucked up fancy restaurant, and I'm looking forward to the day when I can't get a reservation.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and that, of course, was the iconic Zacchaeus Jackson, you know, the late, great spoken word poet, you know, indigenous man, you know, I believe he was of the Blackfoot Nation, and that poem, of course, like, really just captures everything that Stephanie Adohi was really talking about, you know, and she was talking about what Columbus Day really means, when she's talking about what the 4th of July really means, and all these other celebrations of the founding of countries, of these settler colonial countries, you know, what they really mean, you know, because really what happens, of course, you know, the European empires, you know, and you say the follow-up empires they established, such as the United States, you know, they killed the first peoples of this continent, you know, and basically enslaved the continent for 300 years, you know. And the important thing is, well, you know, at least there were, the thing is, in South America, the land of the condor, of course, as the Susan Adohi put it, more and more people understand that, you know. In fact, even Simon Bolivar, you know, who's called, of course, the liberator, you know, the one, of course, like, it was largely responsible for liberating South America from Spanish colonialism, Spanish colonial rule. He understood that. He understood that it was necessary to stand up for the rights of indigenous people, even then, even in the 1820s. But in North America, where, of course, the settler population has, you know, dwarfs the indigenous population by many, many times over, we don't see the same conditions. We see this, even to this day, this attempt to push the indigenous people to the margins, trivialize their struggles, and almost pretend they don't exist. Wanting them to go away, wanting them to disappear. And we see a similar dynamic playing out in places like Australia, you know, another settler colonial state. And we just have to understand how abnormal this is. This is not the case throughout the rest of the world, where the indigenous population has been so marginalized, such a victim of genocide, where it is now but a fraction of its former size and outnumbered many times over by a settler population made up mostly of people of European descent. You know, this is not a normal condition, and we should stop acting like it is a normal condition. You know, and certainly what I saw when I was in places like China or even in Russia, you know, I saw how abnormal in many ways Canada really is and not in a good way. Because here, of course, you know, you have that colossal distortion of history and this colossal attempt to make, portray that everything is fine, when of course it's not fine. There's this underlying injustice that has existed in this country since its foundation. This country really is built on rotten foundations. And until we address this, until the indigenous people of this land have self-determination, until the settler population of this country stops being this colonial force, you know, and, you know, redefines itself, you know, as a population of internationalists willing to respect and uphold self-determination as a principle above all else, you know, standing in solidarity with the other peoples of this world and rejecting empire, rejecting colonialism, then there is absolutely no way I can call this land, in good conscience, I can call it my land, my motherland, or anything like that. You know, there has to be self-determination on this land. The indigenous people have to be free. They have to have self-determination. They have to decide their own affairs. They have to have control of their land, and their own resources, and their own government, and all these things, their own culture. And we have to respect the two-world wampum. You know, as settlers, we can develop ourselves, we can go our own way, but of course we also have to respect the indigenous people, their self-determination, their culture, their government, their self-determination. That's the true world wampum. That is what they want. It's all they're asking for from us. That we respect them. We don't interfere with their affairs. You know, this is what they want. And we need to respect that. And really, we're the ones who need to change ourselves so that we can respect that. Because right now, the settler colonial culture does not allow us to respect that. You know, because of course, what is it based on? Imperialism. And imperialism does not tolerate self-determination. It's the total opposite. So in many cases, and I've said this before, we need to free ourselves from this imperialist identity that's been twisting us and turning us into something that we're not. We have to understand that we're better than this. And that's the only way we're going to see justice done in this country. And we're the ones who need to change, and we should stop expecting, you know, we, of course, as people of European descent, we're the ones who need to change. We should stop expecting others to conform to us and view us as the standard that they should measure themselves by. We need to understand that we are one people amongst many. You know, one people amongst many. And, you know, we should use that. We should stand with other people as opposed to trying to control other people. Or impose ourselves on other people. Very, very important to understand. So what I'm going to play right now is I'm going to play an interview that was done last year by the Vancouver Media Co-op. And this particular interview was done with Frida Hewson, who is a indigenous activist and is part of the Unistaten blockade of a proposed pipeline route in BC. You know, this is unceded native land in BC. Yet these guys have to fight tooth and nail to keep it from being, you know, bisected by these oil pipelines that the Canadian government is trying to build across the BC mountain range, and causing incalculable environmental damage in the process and running roughshod over the rights of indigenous people. So you see, this is what's going on right now. This is what needs to be addressed in this country. you know, before we can. You know, we need to address this underlying injustice before we can ever celebrate this land, this country. There's work to do, brothers and sisters. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Could you just identify yourself for the record?
Katie Houston, who is that in camp?
And I'm Brett Rhino from Media Co-op. And first question is, would a deal between the Morristown Band Council and PTP have any jurisdiction over traditional Unist'ot'en territory?
No, band councils and tribal councils do not have jurisdiction on Unist'ot'en territory. We're a hereditary system which has five clans, and each of those five clans are broken into house groups, and the only one that doesn't have house group but just has a description of the territory is my clan, which is known to the Delgamuukw as Gessehiu, but people better know my family as Unist'ot'en, which we're probably the one of the largest families and the largest group in the Gessehiu clan, and we have jurisdiction, have proved it in the Delgamuukw, and we've never given over that jurisdiction to the province, the federal government, or the band councils or tribal councils.
And what would you like to say to any band council members who may be considering such a deal with PTP?
That I've already said it right to their face, that band council is a system that was imposed by the federal government just so they can try to take over management of our lands and resources. So it's not even a system where they even have any kind of decision-making power. It's just implementing policies and programs that are developed from Indian Affairs and white society, taking care of us, and basically they're just implementing whatever they decide. And one and foremost, they're Wet'suwet'en, and one and foremost, they belong to a clan. They are that before they are a band counselor or a chief counselor, and each and every one of them belong to a clan, whether it be Tsayu, Lhkhsilyu, Gidimdan, Lhkxamasu, or Gessehiu. And they're that foremost. And according to Wet'suwet'en law, you can't make decision on another clan's territory. The only people that can make a decision on Unist'ot'en territory is Unist'ot'en people. Nobody from any other clan can decide for us what happens to our lands.
Okay. And what actions have you taken since you found out about the proposed deal?
We've made it public, the deal that was trying to be proposed, and I phoned the office of Wet'suwet'en questioning them about that